Of the five major study reports posted immediately on the San Antonio website during the meeting was a paper presented by Dr. Bill Gradishar of a randomized phase 2 study which demonstrated greater response rates and longer time to progression with nab-paclitaxel in different weekly schedules compared to Q3-week docetaxel. I met with Dr. Andrew Seidman to learn about his research on NAB, and he began by commenting on a study combining this agent with bevacizumab.
I'm running a trial that we're leading, Memorial's lead institution, and we've extended to other institutions because it's too ambitious for us to do on our own. It's a randomized trial of weekly versus Q2-week versus Q3-week Abraxane, where Avastin is given concurrently, first-line therapy, metastatic breast cancer. So following ECOG 2100 and given the benefits of Abraxane compared to Taxol, we decided to look in a randomized phase 2 fashion at the package insert 260 per meter squared every 3-week dose, a dose-dense scheduling 260 per meter squared every 2 weeks with GCSF, and we have another arm which is 130 per meter squared, which is weekly without interruption in a sort of CALGB 9840 kind of fashion. All patients get Avastin. And the target accrual is 225 patients, so 75 patients per arm. And we've had our first interim safety analysis at about 20 patients per arm, and so far there has not been any signal that we should stop accrual to any of the arms because of excessive toxicity.
So the patients get randomized to one of these three?
It's a randomized phase 2.
Interesting. Yep. Have you treated a number of these patients yourself?
Yeah, oh, for sure. We're the lead accruer. And I can say that, you know, the 260 per meter squared every 2 weeks, there has been a more neuropathy, as you would expect. Nick Robert last year here at San Antonio reported on integrating Abraxane in a dose-dense sequential AC Abraxane fashion where it was a pilot study with 30 patients where giving 4 cycles of Abraxane 260 per meter squared every 2 weeks caused grade 3 neuropathy in about 14% of patients, which is a little bit more than you might expect with just conventional Taxol.
And they also, I think, found out that you needed growth factors.
Right.
And so you're using growth factors.
Yes, we are. Absolutely.
It's been a little bit hard for me to get a handle on NAB, particularly in terms of efficacy and neurotoxicity and the duration of it. You know, you hear people talking about the fact that the neurotoxicity goes away quicker. Is that a reality?
Well, you know, I think that little nugget of wisdom came from the randomized trial that Bill Gradishar published, and it appeared that for the patients who developed grade 3 neuropathy in that randomized trial, by the time the next cycle came around after their grade 3 neuropathy occurred, most of those patients, 10 out of 14, I think, had recovered sufficiently so that they could be retreated, albeit at a lower dose. Since I tend to use weekly scheduling with any taxane that I choose, I think I don't bump into that grade 3 neuropathy quite as often. I know a lot of docs who are giving weekly Taxol or Abraxane tend to use a 3 weeks on, 1 week off schedule. I also think that 1 week off per month ameliorates the potential for cumulative neuropathy. But, you know, in terms of the comparative reversibility, I don't have a good sense of that. And hopefully the U.S. Oncology pilot trial that Nick Robert reported will be able to have some follow-up in terms of how reversible the 4 out of 30 patients or 14% who had grade 3 neuropathy. I haven't heard about what the sequela of that are, but we're actually now in the midst of a trial. My colleague Maura Dickler is using dose-dense AC Abraxane in the exact same format that Nick reported on the U.S. Oncology pilot, where we are studying the feasibility of giving bevacizumab, Avastin, in a pilot adjuvant trial. So it's a non-randomized feasibility trial. We're using the same doses of AC and Abraxane that Nick reported on here last year with bevacizumab concurrently. We've entered about 35 patients or so, and so far there hasn't been any untoward signal that this is prohibitively toxic.
Another thing that's been hard to get a handle on, our patterns of care study actually shows that most oncologists and breast cancer clinical researchers have the belief that NAB is more effective than cremaphore paclitaxel. I imagine based on Bill Gradishar's study. Do you think that's a reality?
For me, I'm convinced by the trial that led to Abraxane's FDA approval that at least Abraxane at 260 per meter squared is not less effective than paclitaxel and cremaphore at 175. And for me, not having to give pre-medications, not having to give corticosteroids, being able to infuse the drug over half an hour instead of 3 hours if you're going to give it every 3 weeks. The ability to avoid steroids in my patients is a big plus, and not to have to worry about potentially just simply scary allergic reactions, but occasionally life-threatening allergic reactions. For me, that's a no-brainer in terms of what taxane I would want to choose.
It's interesting, though. Not everybody feels that way. There are a lot of people who think, steroids are no big deal.
I think that steroids are a double-edged sword. For me, often the prescription for steroids comes along with a prescription for Ambien, you know, because patients can't sleep well at night. With weekly taxanes and weekly steroids, I do see proximal myopathy, steroid myopathy, occasionally diabetics who have trouble controlling their blood sugars. From most physicians, what I hear most that limits the uptake of nab-paclitaxel is the pharmacoeconomics of this drug, and that I don't have any great response to.
Yeah, no, it's vexing, although, you know, I'm starting to hear more people say, if I say, okay, suppose the two drugs were exactly the same cost, and a lot of people say, well, I've never used crambeforepaclitaxel. Is that the way you feel?
If that were the case, I think that there would be no reason that would make a doc lean in the direction of giving a drug in crambefor. You know, we have a randomized trial showing improved response rate and a modest improvement in time to progression for nab-paclitaxel over crambefor-based paclitaxel. There is some margin of safety. Anyone who's experienced a few scary hypersensitivity reactions during their outpatient clinic knows what the impact of that is on the oncology nurses, the other patients in the waiting room who see the team running in with the crash cart. It's hard to put a dollar basis on what it's worth to avoid those kinds of events. But if I was a CEO of a pharmaceutical company where I was given, you know, drug A, drug B, and drug C, where drug A was paclitaxel and crambefor, drug B was docetaxel in tween 80 or polysorbate, and drug C was paclitaxel and nanoparticles of albumin, and I knew everything about those three drugs, A, B, and C, that we know now, for me it would be a no-brainer what drug I would want to put in my company's portfolio.
Yeah, it's really kind of vexing. I think the related issue, and it kind of reminds me a little bit about capecitabine in colon cancer, in that you have a drug that looks pretty similar, and the question is, how far do you have to test it in every situation? Are we going to have to do adjuvant trials? I mean, what are we going to have to do?
I am old enough and have been at this long enough to remember filling up balloons with 5-fluorouracil and putting them in Baxter pumps and infusing them in my ambulatory outpatients. So for breast cancer docs, it's been a very easy transition, I think, from infusional 5-FU to capecitabine.
But, you know, it seems like more and more you see evidence that capecitabine and 5-FU or infusional 5-FU are similar, preoperative therapy for rectal cancer, adjuvant therapy, and yet people are looking, the trials are being done, and, you know, capecitabine is not being used, and kind of it looks like the same thing's happening with NAB. Do you think we're going to need phase 3 adjuvant trials?
I think the issue still probably revolves around what makes physicians' practices viable. And you may have the data on this, Neil, from some surveys that you've done about whether the differential use of capecitabine between academic centers and community-based centers may be different. In academic centers, since folks like I are salaried, I don't think twice about prescribing the drug that I think is right. And if that drug is capecitabine and it liberates the patient from frequent visits to the clinic for intravenous therapy, then that's what I'm going to prescribe. If it's a private practice where there may be a financial incentive for parenteral drug administration, then that may ultimately trump any data that you will generate.
I think there's also sensitivity to how much the patient might have to pay out of pocket to actually get the prescription filled. But certainly in breast cancer, actually, we see a big difference between the use of capecitabine in academia and in practice, and it's used much more frequently by clinical investigators.
You know, the one scenario that where I tend to see doctors not hesitate to give capecitabine in breast cancer is the unique scenario where patients have had preoperative chemotherapy, often with an anthracycline and a taxane. At the time of surgery, the patient has significant residual disease, perhaps at least 2 centimeters of invasive cancer in the breast, perhaps a significant number of nodes that are still involved despite anthracycline and taxane. And in particular, those patients whose disease is ER negative, where you just can't say, well, now I'm going to give you an antiestrogen. A lot of docs are in the habit of prescribing capecitabine, and we know that there's no data to address this. If the question were on a board exam and my oncology fellows were asked what the right answer was, it would be no further systemic therapy. But I know that many docs, cost considerations aside, feel the need to do something. And in fact, I think the time is ripe for a randomized trial, since a lot of docs are prescribing capecitabine in this significant residual disease after preoperative chemotherapy.
I think actually Hal Burstein is going to be doing this with his metronomic, what is it, cyclophosphamide, methotrexate, yep, plus Bev. I don't think it's randomized, but it is going to look at exactly that situation.
Yeah, certainly the notion that anti-angiogenic therapy can have a role in this minimal residual disease setting is very appropriate, and the work from Dana-Farber is clearly moving in that direction. There's no reason why capecitabine couldn't be considered in a similar kind of trial with or without the addition of an anti-angiogenic agent, whether it be Bev or sunitinib or something like that.
Speaking of anti-angiogenesis, and you mentioned your trial that's going to include bevacizumab, right now, how do you incorporate bevacizumab into your practice in a non-protocol setting in breast cancer?
For the most part, I currently pretty much follow the E2100 paradigm. So for the patients who aren't going on the trial that I described a moment ago, who aren't going to be randomized to different schedules of nab-paclitaxel and get bevacizumab, most of those patients will be appropriately treated with taxanes, and I'll give them paclitaxel with bevacizumab. I have occasionally patients who have had adjuvant taxane within the last year who relapse, and my inclination at that point is to use capecitabine and bevacizumab based on Kathy Miller's reported phase 3 trial. So those are probably the two most common scenarios.
It's interesting, too, because there are people, a lot of people who looked at that capecitabine Bev trial and said, well, it was, quote, negative, and they don't want to use capecitabine and Bev.
Right. So despite a doubling of response rate, a lack of significant prolongation in time to progression, I think, is concerning. There certainly is a difference in that population compared to E2100 with regards to extent of prior therapy. I don't see any great reason to suspect that the addition of Bev to any particular specific cytotoxic agent in breast cancer is going to make a big difference in terms of efficacy. The RIBBON-1 trial, which will allow a repertoire of different chemotherapy regimens that are commonly given in the first-line setting, should inform us about whether we really need to worry about whether it's a taxane or an anthracycline or capecitabine, vinorelbine, etc.
There was also George Sledge's Excalibur study that looked at capecitabine Bev in a first-line setting.
Right. It's a phase 2 trial. It's hard to know what to make because there's no control arm. I think the nice thing is that there does seem to be efficacy that is not dissimilar to what Kathy Miller previously reported at a lower dose of capecitabine. In this trial, she used 1,000 milligrams per meter squared orally twice a day instead of 1,250 in the Excalibur trial compared to the previously published phase 3 trials.
How do you see Bev fitting in the adjuvant setting? Obviously, it's going to be studied. It is being studied. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, first, there's the theoretical consideration that at smaller volumes of cancer, angiogenesis seems to be driven more by VEGF than other growth factors. And with larger tumor volumes, a greater list of growth factors seem to come into play. So there's every reason to hope and believe that perturbing VEGF receptor activation will have a big impact in the adjuvant setting. So right now, I think we're doing all the right things. The pilot study, ECOG 2104, I believe is the number, has been completed, which will inform the design of a larger randomized phase 3 trial, specifically addressing the issue of whether one can safely give bevacizumab concurrently with an anthracycline or whether you should wait until anthracycline is finished. So in that trial, the chemotherapy regimen chosen was, of course, one close to my heart, the dose-dense AC paclitaxel regimen. I think that the time is right. I think physicians clearly will have equipoise on the issue and will be wanting to randomize patients to get an anti-angiogenic agent in the adjuvant setting, and I think patient acceptance is going to be tremendous.
Another issue related to Bev, I'm curious about your thoughts on, is the question of combining it with hormone therapy. Mara Dickler from your place has reported some work on that. Where are we with that, and where is it heading?
Yeah, I'm not sure where, if indeed, a final trial design plan has been decided upon, but we certainly showed the feasibility of combining an aromatase inhibitor in our pilot. It happened to be letrozole with bevacizumab. I believe the design is going to be somewhat liberal. There have been discussions in the breast committee at CLGB about whether we should specify any particular aromatase inhibitor or just let it be dealer's choice, let docs choose their particular aromatase inhibitor and combine it with bevacizumab. I personally don't see any great scientific basis to choose one AI over another to combine bevacizumab with. But given that there is crosstalk between estrogen signaling and VEGF signaling, the most obvious example of estrogen-related angiogenesis being the cyclic changes in endometrial proliferation.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. You know, there's certainly a hope that intervening earlier with anti-angiogenic therapy before you cross the bridge to need chemotherapy might be beneficial.
That's interesting. What do we know about estrogens and why it does cause that in the uterus? I never thought about that.
Great question for Kent Osborne.
Speaking of Kent Osborne and crosstalk, and he's been talking about HER2 and the ER for a while, and we now have the tandem data looking at anastrozole plus trastuzumab in the metastatic setting, and John Mackey presented that here in San Antonio. Can you talk about what that study looked at and what your thoughts were about
it? Yeah, I mean, I first glimpsed those data a few weeks after they were first presented in Istanbul at ESMO this September. And basically, one thing I was struck by was in the control arm, in the anastrozole alone arm, the median time to progression was 2.4 months. So granted, it's ER-positive, HER2-positive disease, but that duration of response to anastrozole alone doesn't seem to fit with what I see clinically. I have many patients in my own practice who are ER-positive, HER2-positive, who do fine in the absence of trastuzumab. With trastuzumab, there was a doubling of time to progression from 2.4 to 4.8 months. The bigger question, I guess, is if you're going to use those data for your patient who would appropriately get an aromatase inhibitor and add Herceptin at that point, what then is the implication of playing your trastuzumab card, if you will, at that point when the patient ultimately develops hormone refractory disease? And here we know that there's a survival advantage for adding trastuzumab to chemotherapy, paclitaxel or docetaxel. So I'm not quite yet to use the tandem data to change my practice. Having said that, there are certain patients in certain scenarios who come to me who are getting anti-estrogens and Herceptin, but there are usually some strange, unique aspect about their clinical story that makes me feel it's an appropriate thing to do.
Well, yeah, it's something that probably wasn't done hardly at all in the past. And then I guess the way we got our feet wet was in the adjuvant setting when people are getting trastuzumab and they get the hormone therapy. Of course, now we're talking about metastatic disease.
Right. And I think the patients, for example, one easy, I guess, application of the tandem data in clinical practice could be for the occasional patient who's had an adjuvant tamoxifen but not an aromatase inhibitor, who then receives chemotherapy and trastuzumab when she develops metastatic disease. Most of us are in the habit of stopping the chemotherapy at a certain point and just simply continuing trastuzumab. So here, for the patient who has not yet had an aromatase inhibitor, one appropriate scenario could be to use chemotherapy and Herceptin to maximum response or to the point where toxicity begins to accumulate, toss the chemotherapy aside, and at that point, add the aromatase inhibitor. That's, for me, is a no-brainer. And certainly there are those patients who never had adjuvant therapy, maybe present with metastatic disease, where you feel the first right thing to do is to give chemo and Herceptin, despite the fact that the ER is positive. Maybe you should play that card, give chemotherapy and Herceptin first, and then toss the chemotherapy aside and use the aromatase inhibitor out back instead of up front.
Can you update us on where we are with dose-dense ACT trastuzumab that you all have been working with?
Yeah, so Chow Dang presented what probably will be the final report, having presented this both here in San Antonio last year and also at ASCO, on our pilot study of dose-dense AC, paclitaxel, and Herceptin. Just to set some of the background, I think it's important to note that neither the NSABP B31 nor the NCCTG 9831 or intergroup Herceptin trials chose to employ the dose-dense AC paclitaxel as the mode of administration for those agents. So we did feel somewhat of an obligation to generate some cardiac safety data because certainly we have a bias to the sequential dose-dense administration of those agents. So in that spirit, we treated 70 patients with dose-dense sequential AC paclitaxel where Herceptin was initiated at the same time as paclitaxel and given weekly during paclitaxel, and then continued Q3 weeks at 6 milligrams per kilogram in the sort of HERA model so that patients would complete a full year. Cardiac function, left ventricular ejection fraction, was monitored at baseline after 4 cycles of AC, after paclitaxel, and then at a more remote time point at about 9 months. And what Chow basically is updating here in San Antonio is the fact that we have not crossed our threshold to call this a regimen that is unsafe for the myocardium. we decided that if at least four patients developed significant cardiac dysfunction, that we would call this not safe. In fact, only one patient had a significant decline in left ventricular function. There were some patients who had milder, reversible declines in left ventricular ejection fraction. So this is currently my standard of practice outside the context of a trial, is to give dose-dense AC paclitaxel with trastuzumab based on the cardiac safety data that we've generated.
In terms of what you have seen, does it look comparable to non-dose-dense AC paclitaxel in terms of the ejection fraction results?
Yeah.
Or better?
Probably not any different. The median left ventricular ejection fraction really drifted down very modestly, I think by a few percentage points from beginning to end. It will be important to follow these patients longer.
I wanted to follow up a little bit in terms of the issue of dose tenses. One of the things that we're seeing in our patterns of care studies, and I'm curious what your take is increasing use of dose dense AC without paclitaxel. Is that something you do in your practice, and what are your thoughts about it?
So to be sure, CLGB 9741 doesn't inform us about which component of the regimen, AC or paclitaxel, is most important, if there is one component, to give in a dose-dense fashion. So I don't see any reason to necessarily differentiate the two components based on anything we know about their mechanisms of action, for example. When I do have a patient for whom I feel a taxane isn't so crucial, and maybe that's the node-negative patient whose disease is ER-positive and she's going to derive benefit from antiestrogen, where I don't think the taxane component is so important, my habit is to give AC times 4 in a dose-dense fashion. We await the results of the CLGB-led trial, which compares dose-dense AC times 4 versus dose-dense AC times 6, where in a bifactorial design, the other two comparators are paclitaxel, dose-dense times 4, or dose-dense times 6. So I think that those results will help us, number one, in the duration question, but also to determine whether we might perhaps in certain lower-risk group patients be able to avoid an anthracycline entirely. I've certainly had scenarios where I've had a patient who's had a second primary tumor. A woman may have had AC or FEC or FAC in the past, where I may want to avoid an anthracycline again, even avoid an alkylating agent again. So I think these data are going to be important from a number of perspectives.
Of course, they won't tell us whether dose-dense AC is the same as non-dose-dense AC.
No, and I'm not aware of any trial that's actually asking that specific question.
Well, again, kind of getting back to this theme of when do you make your move, it seems like a lot of people are starting to do that based on just what they've observed in terms of how people tolerate dose-dense AC as opposed to non-dose-dense AC.
Yeah, I think that for docs who feel that, for example, bone pain from Neupogen or Neulasta is a significant issue, they may be inclined away from extrapolating and giving AC in a dose-dense fashion.
Plus the cost.
Yeah, and the cost. But again, I can't tease out which component of AC paclitaxel is most important, if there is any. All I can say is that as a regimen, when one is going to give those drugs, that seems to be the appropriate way to give it. Charlie Shapiro, my CLGB colleague at Ohio State University, had a poster showing the feasibility of using a dose-dense sequential AC taxotere, a docetaxel regimen. But in order to do that, the docetaxel dose was 75 milligrams per meter squared, and that's feasible if you give docetaxel at 75 per meter squared every 2 weeks. Others have previously reported that giving 100 per meter squared every 2 weeks in a regimen with dose-dense anthracycline was prohibitively toxic. I believe John Crown, George Raptis, I think, may have reported on that previously.
So what did these data show?
So these data showed feasibility, reasonable toxicity, if you want to give a dose-dense sequential regimen where docetaxel is reduced from 100 to 75. There was no comparator arm, so we can't say how this compares to anything else. Should we be concerned about a dose reduction of docetaxel in the adjuvant setting? Perhaps yes, since in metastatic disease, a randomized trial has shown us that 100 per meter squared is a more active regimen than 75 or 60.
What were your thoughts about the docetaxel cyclophosphamide TC regimen that was presented by Steve Jones last year, U.S. Oncology?
I think it's an important trial. It's a trial that I know is already impacting upon practice from speaking to doctors in the community and even to some of my own colleagues at Memorial who have used it. There are patients for whom docs truly want to avoid an anthracycline, whether they be elderly patients who have cardiac issues, patients who have I think there's also the scenario where a patient might have received one or two cycles of AC, and even with the best anti-emetic regimen, just have an awful time of it. And I think docs will midstream switch and complete the regimen with TC, even if they don't choose to do that in the first place. So I think it offers flexibility in treatment decision making.
And you hear people talking about that, but yet if you actually look at what he presented, I mean, there were fewer relapses and deaths compared to AC.
Yeah, I mean, the data stand just by themselves. So for a patient for whom you would give AC to, this is a very reasonable alternative. Having said that, if you consider the body of data that it took to convince docs to simply adopt an anthracycline compared to just CMF and CMF variants, it was a long list of trials involving thousands of patients. Here we're looking at one trial involving, I believe it was hundreds of patients or about 1,000 patients.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's very encouraging. Do I think that we should overnight simply abandon AC as a standard of care? Probably not.
What were your thoughts about the data that was presented at the last ASCO meeting on the anthracycline cardiotoxicity? There were a couple of papers presented, and the cardiologist from Memorial, Richard Steingart, did the discussion there. What was your takeaway from all that?
Well, I think that we try to distinguish between cardiac toxicity from anthracyclines as compared to cardiac toxicity from trastuzumab. One of the important take-home points that Rich Steingart made in reviewing the data were that still the benefits of anthracyclines and of trastuzumab in curing a fatal disease, that is a potentially fatal disease, that is breast cancer, still greatly overshadow the cardiac concerns. We oncologists tend to be very attuned, and I think it's commendable, to the harm that we can do patients. But still, for the vast majority of patients in whom we feel an anthracycline or trastuzumab are necessary, the benefits almost always outweigh the harm. Having said that, the second important, I think, eye-opening message that I got from Rich Steingart's presentation was that most oncologists don't look beyond left ventricular ejection fraction. We do MUGAs, we do echocardiograms. Cardiologists know that there's a lot more to myocardial dysfunction than simply measuring ejection fraction. Diastolic dysfunction, in particular, can cause symptomatic changes in cardiac function. So I think we as oncologists will also become more sophisticated and find new tools to measure cardiac dysfunction other than simply looking at left ventricular ejection fraction.
Another thing that happened at this San Antonio meeting was interesting was Peter Rabdin's presentation looking at the incidence or decreasing incidence of breast cancer and presumably hooked up to the decreasing use of postmenopausal hormone replacement therapy. What were your thoughts about that?
Yeah, Dr. Rabdin reported a rather abrupt decrease in the incidence of both invasive and non-invasive breast cancer in the year 2003. The decline in invasive breast cancer was 7%, which was quite distinctly different from what we had seen in previous years. Other secondary observations were that the decline was greater in the occurrence of estrogen receptor positive breast cancers, and particularly in the 50 to 69-year-old age group. So there was speculation about why this should be. One of those reasons for speculation was the presentation of the results of the Women's Health Initiative trial with regards to hormone replacement therapy, which was presented 1 year prior in 2002. There was perhaps the hypothesis that a sudden change in hormone replacement therapy practice, that is, a lot of women coming off of hormone replacement therapy and fewer women beginning hormone replacement therapy, would play into this. I have a little trouble with this because of simply the temporal relationship between the announcements of those results and the observation of reduction in breast cancer incidence. I would expect to see perhaps the need for more longer latency period, a more waiting period to determine if that's the case. If indeed this reduction seems to persist in 2004, 2005, then I think it makes a stronger case that a change in prescribing patterns for hormone replacement therapy could have made a difference. Although the Women's Health Initiative trial would suggest that it wasn't such a dramatic difference. There was an increased incidence of breast cancer with hormone replacement therapy, but it wasn't quite as dramatic as the decline seen in this analysis.
Well, it'll be interesting. I think there'll be another cut of this data in about 6 months. It'll be interesting to see what they found. Another paper presented here I was curious about your take on was Bill Gradishar's presentation of the EFFECT trial. Can you go into what that looked at and what your thoughts were about what was presented?
Bill Gradishar today presented on the results of a randomized trial where patients with metastatic breast cancer progressing despite treatment with a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor were randomized to the steroidal aromatase inhibitor exemestane or to fulvestrant. many of us have been using both of these approaches somewhat indiscriminately, perhaps being influenced more by patient preference for monthly injection as opposed to taking a pill, perhaps being influenced by other factors as well. But what Bill basically showed was very similar outcomes, whether patients continued on a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor or monthly injections of fulvestrant. Indeed, a loading schedule for fulvestrant was employed in this trial, which is what I tend to use in my own practice. And probably if one is going to choose to use fulvestrant, one should probably follow the design of this trial and indeed employ the 500 milligram loading dose followed by a subsequent dose of 250.
How was it, 2 weeks?
2 weeks later, and then 250 milligrams monthly. There were some modest efficacy benefits for fulvestrant over exemestane. So I think this simply allows us to have flexibility in treatment options, and I think most likely most clinicians will be influenced by patient preferences in terms of the choice of continuing on oral medication or a monthly injection. For many patients who are coming in monthly, for example, bisphosphonate, it doesn't ask much more of the patient in terms of frequent office visits.
Any thoughts about where you think fulvestrant is heading in terms of integration into clinical trials?
For me, in metastatic breast cancer, I think of hormone-sensitive disease as a story that has many chapters, and I try to, as much as possible, exhaust all of my anti-estrogen options before moving on to cytotoxic chemotherapy. So we've all seen patients who can survive many, many years, sometimes even a decade, before they need to actually cross that bridge. So to have more weapons in our arsenal, so to speak, before we choose to use chemotherapy can only be a positive thing. I could envision a world where we have 5 or 6 lines of anti-estrogen therapies, which each agent may have its own unique mechanism of action beyond tamoxifen, beyond aromatase inhibition, beyond selective estrogen receptor downregulators, and most likely we will see novel anti-estrogens, which will make the list even longer.
Another endocrine trial that was reported here that was very interesting was the NSABP B33 study that Terry Mamounis reported this morning. Can you talk about what the trial looked at and what your take was and what he presented?
Yeah, so the NSABP B33 trial had a similar design to the MA17 study, in that after 5 years of adjuvant tamoxifen, postmenopausal women with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer were randomized to receive an aromatase inhibitor, in this case exemestane, or placebo for an additional 5 years. During the conduct of this trial, the results of MA17 were made public, and indeed at that moment the trial was unblinded and patients who were randomized to placebo were offered the opportunity to receive an aromatase inhibitor, despite that potential confounding.
And he actually showed numbers that a lot of people
about 44% of patients on the placebo arm chose to take an aromatase inhibitor.
I know, when he showed that, I was thinking the next thing he's going to show is it didn't work.
Right, so despite that confounding, right, there was still a benefit. And I think this is just compatible with everything we've learned from all of the other switching studies, and that is aromatase inhibitors do add benefit in the adjuvant setting. This trial doesn't inform us about the relative differences between letrozole and exemestane. One of the things that I will say is I'm always disappointed about the reporting of toxicities in this trial. And in particular, what struck me during Dr. Mamounis' presentation was the difference in arthralgia and joint pain or joint stiffness. This may have been lost on a lot of people who are sitting in a dark room for a long period of time, but what Terry showed was the difference in grade 3 arthralgia. And the difference between placebo and exemestane was 0.5%. It was 0.5% for placebo and 1% for exemestane.
Right, I noticed.
Now, for those of us who treat patients with aromatase inhibitors, that observation that he shared doesn't simply reflect what I encounter in my clinical practice. I'd have to go back and look at the common toxicity criteria to see what indeed a grade 2 arthralgia is. But I think there's a lot of significant joint stiffness and joint symptoms that goes under the radar screen when these phase 3 trials are presented. And for many patients, this ends up being the deal breaker.
Yeah, it's interesting. In our patterns of care studies, we ask docs, you know, sort of roughly speaking about what fraction of patients who get AIs have bad enough arthralgias that it's a problem. They think about switching. They think about stopping.
We play musical AIs. You know, we have a patient who's not doing well on one and we'll try another, often switching from steroidal to non-steroidal or vice versa. I'm not convinced that I can really tell a difference.
But what fraction of patients that you start on AIs, you know, have that kind of difficulty, would you say?
Well, having difficulty where patients will, I say, describe significant distress on a daily basis, probably in the range of about 15%.
Our doctor
for patients who feel distressed enough to want to stop the drug, Or sometimes what I'll do is, if I'm not certain whether it's actually the AI or some other cause, I may invite the patient for a holiday off of the AI for a month. And if their symptoms improve dramatically and they feel much better, some of those patients don't want to go back on and will think about other options, including tamoxifen.
I guess the other thing related to that study that he brought out is the question of duration of AIs in his trial, or the trial that he's the PI on, that's going to look at 5 versus 10 years of aromatase therapy.
Certainly in MA17, those patients who completed their 5 years of letrozole were invited to be randomized, to continue to be re-randomized. One of those patients was one of my own patients, and I'll tell you that she came in at that 5-year mark. And she knows I like Starbucks coffee. She brought me 3-pound bags of Starbucks because she thought she could bribe me into simply prescribing an additional 5 years of letrozole. I told her I couldn't do that with good conscience because I had no idea whether it was beneficial, and I knew that there's a potential downside in terms of fracture risk, etc.
Now, she had already had 10 years of hormonal therapy.
So she had finished 5 years of tamoxifen, 5 years of letrozole. Granted, she had 8 positive axillary nodes, and she was concerned about stopping, but after some thoughtful discussion that took about a half an hour, she agreed to be re-randomized. I hope that the event rate for those patients who have already finished 5 years of TAM and 5 years of letrozole, and then who agree to be re-randomized on MA17 or similar trials, will be high enough that we'll be able to see some difference. I wonder if the event rate is going to be high enough that we'll be able to really know whether going beyond 10 years is going to be beneficial.
And that issue about the long-term event rate and how do you estimate the residual risk of relapse in a patient who has an ER-positive tumor who's out, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15 years, do we have anything to go on?
I don't know what the absolute numbers are. Certainly for patients with ER-positive disease, we know that the period of time for which they are at risk for relapse tends to be steady and prolonged as compared to patients who have ER-negative disease. So there will be events that will occur. I think the key is how powered will it be. I think in MA17, the number of patients who were eligible for re-randomization at 10 years was in a range of about 900 or 1,000 or so. How many of those women will be willing to be re-randomized is, I think, the key.
What are you doing in your practice when a patient who's been treated with an upfront AI hits 5 years?
I generally say no more anti-estrogen therapy. So I'm intrigued by the possibility that the inverse sequence, that is AI followed by tamoxifen, may be just as effective, or there may be some differential effect. But in the absence of data, I just tend to stop an AI at 5 years. My practice is generally to use an AI in my postmenopausal women. For those patients who have switched at 2 years, my inclination is, as long as they're not having excessive toxicity, which is most patients, I will generally continue the AI for a full 5 years. Those patients would get 7 years of anti-estrogen therapy.